Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Professional Responsibility Practice Group is hosting a discussion on the book, The Politically Correct University. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers.
Good afternoon. I'm Jack Park, and this podcast will deal with a book that was published in 2009 by the American Enterprise Institute Press. It's called The Politically Correct University, Problems, Scope, and Reforms. It's a series of essays edited by Robert Maranto, Richard Redding, and Frederick Hess. And we're fortunate today to have Richard Redding, Associate Dean and Professor of Law at Chapman University School of Law, to talk about the book. Richard, do you want to get started by telling us how the book is set up and what it does?
Sure. Thank you, Jack. One often hears over the years complaints from conservative professors and students and alumni about the lack of ideological diversity in today's colleges and universities on campus. But most of this has been limited to anecdotal accounts. So what we aim to do, set out to do in this book, was to gather together 19 leading scholars, both in and outside of the academy, to take a look at this problem from an empirical, systematic perspective, to ask the question, exactly how rare are conservative professors? Why are they so rare? How might this vary by discipline? And importantly, what are the effects of this political homogeneity on campuses and academic life? And what might be the possibilities for how the politically correct university might be reformed? So the book is divided into three sections. In the first section, we diagnose the problem. We document through a series of empirical studies the problem of the lack of conservative voices and conservative professors on campus. In the second part of the book, we explore the implications of this across various academic disciplines and talk about how the problem may have developed. And then finally, in the last section of the book, we talk about possible reforms.
And the book does say that, the purpose is to move beyond the anecdotal to provide empirically and historically grounded criticism of academia, combined with ideas about how to make academia truer to its social purpose of gaining and disseminating knowledge. Turning to the empirical data, do you want to lay some of that out for us?
Sure. We begin by documenting the numbers of conservative or libertarian professors at various colleges and universities across disciplines. And this was done through a series of studies done by Daniel Klein and Charlotta Stern, looking at publicly available voter registration data of the professoriate, surveys that have been done over the years, including very recently asking them about their political views. And indeed, you find a very significant skewing towards liberal ideology among the professorates. So, for example, in English departments, there's a 34-to-1 ratio between liberals and conservatives. In psychology, 9-to-1. In history, 18-to-1. If one looks at the various disciplines broadly, you find the greatest imbalance in the humanities and social science with overall ratios of 10 to 1, 9 to 1, 8 to 1. It's less in the sciences, 3 to 1. But of course, in disciplines like the humanities and the social sciences, those are exactly the disciplines where ideology actually matters in terms of the kinds of research that's being done. We then moved to an empirical study, another set of empirical studies, one looking at the National Survey of College and University Seniors, and another looking at an empirical study done looking at faculty hiring, to ask the questions, why is it that so few conservatives pursue academic careers and obtain academic jobs. And what those studies find, looking at the survey of college and university seniors, shows that conservative students are substantially less likely to want to pursue doctorates than are similarly situated liberal peers. Now, there are a number of reasons for this. It's not because, as liberals often suggest, that the conservative students may be less intelligent, because we find that liberal and conservative students have identical mean GPAs at schools. But we also find in the survey data that conservative students feel that they lack academic role models, they have more distant relationships with their faculty, fewer opportunities to do research with their professors, all of which is probably due to the mismatch between the professor's ideological views and those of the students. And this, of course, affects students' interest in pursuing graduate education. In terms of faculty hiring, we find through a statistical study that conservative academics must publish more books and articles to get the very same jobs as their liberal peers. While publication records have the most impact on academic success, it remains the case that conservatives are underplaced within the academic meritocracy, with social conservatism having about a third of the statistical impact on career success and a negative impact as done one's publication record. So that that they must publish more and in better journals to get the same jobs than their liberal peers.
And I think it's significant that no matter how this is measured, whether it's Klein and Stern or Rothman and Lichter, whether it's over time or whatever, the common trend or the common balance. The other thing that Rothman and Lichter tend to note is that it seems to have gotten worse over time.
Exactly. I was going to mention that, Jack, that what you find is that the statistical data is very consistent, but it actually seems to be getting worse over time, so that these ratios that I talked about in terms of the imbalance between conservative or libertarian and liberal professors, if you look historically over time, the imbalance is much greater within the last decade or two than it was, for example, back in the 50s or even in the 60s. So it seems to be an accelerating trend.
Does the book offer any explanations for why the trend might be accelerating?
Well, one key reason why we seem to have this phenomenon, I think, is very well explained, again, by Professors Klein and Stern in a chapter where they talk about the groupthink phenomenon, which is that, you get in any social situation where you gather together a large number of individuals who all kind of tend to share the same view on an issue, that a mechanism called groupthink often tends to take over, whereby those members of the organization select members, control members, reward system, and tend to select and reward those like themselves. So that an initial academic orientation towards liberalism that may exist on a faculty only accelerates over the years as this groupthink phenomenon of excluding people whose views differ from the accepted wisdom from the faculty accelerates and gains speed. And not only that, but we also have a few especially prestigious departments across the country whose majoritarian thinking in this regard tends to control departments across the discipline at other schools. So you have a system that develops where there's the failure to explore conservative ideas, failure to critique liberal ones, and an orthodoxy that gets concretized and an increasing exclusion of those who don't share the orthodoxy.
Yeah, as Klein and Stern put it in one of the chapters they contribute, this whole thing tumbles into a self-reinforcing process. It's almost inexorable given the desire of folks to work with folks with whom they're congenial.
That's very true, and that same phenomenon dovetails very nicely with the emphasis in the academy on diversity. which has become the mantra of modern-day higher education that's applied to everything from student admissions to curricula to residence hall life and basically every aspect of college life, as Peter Wood so nicely explores in his chapter. And, of course, the diversity mantra puts an emphasis on diversity of race, ethnicity, gender, and sexual orientation, but not of political views or intellectual views. And so that emphasis on race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation fits very nicely with the liberal groupthink, so that all ideas are kind of, or many ideas that are explored in academia, as we discuss in the second section of the book, revolve around those issues rather than exploring differing political viewpoints, especially conservative or libertarian views.
Do you think Wood is right when he says that reforming the politically correct university seems an unlikely prospect unless we can see a way past the supremacy of the diversity doctrine? And by that, I understand Wood to mean as it is currently construed, not that so as not to take into account kind of political and leanings.
Right. I think that's true. He also points out in his chapter that there may be some hopeful signs on the horizon that the diversity doctrine, with its emphasis on race, ethnicity, sex, and gender orientation to the exclusion of other kinds of diversity, may be starting to wither a bit, where we see ballot initiatives in states outlawing affirmative action, inherent tensions within the diversity doctrine itself. One of the things that I explore with my colleague, Professor O'Donohue, in a chapter on the psychology of political correctness in higher education is this assumption that diversity of race, ethnicity, and so on is really the most important kind of diversity. And we show in our chapter, by relying on a lot of social science and psychological research, as you might expect, that political and ideological diversity is much more important. The rationale for the diversity regime as it is currently practiced in higher education, it basically has three rationales. One, that people's race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation are central to their personal identity, and therefore it's important to recognize and celebrate these identities in pedagogy and university programs. That's what we call the personal identity assumption. The second assumption is what we call the discrimination assumption, that is that people suffer discrimination based on these factors, and that this requires remedies such as diversity training and so on. And then the third assumption we call the educational benefits assumption, which is that with racial, ethnic, and gender diversity comes a diversity of life experiences and values, and that exposing students to these various perspectives has educational benefits. And we deconstruct each of those assumptions and show, again, by relying on empirical social science research, particularly in psychology, how each of those things is even much more true when it comes to intellectual diversity, that is a diversity of ideas, particularly political ideas, that one's political views and ideas are also very central oftentimes to their personal identity, often much more than race or ethnicity, that people are often discriminated against, especially in the academy, based on their political views, and that a diversity of political views is very beneficial and important for education, not only in terms of teaching students, but also by exploring different ideas in research and scholarship.
In your chapter, you wrote with O'Donohue, one of the things that I thought was very interesting is you're noting some, the problems with some of the political correctness assumptions. And the fundamental question, are we individually resilient or fragile? Do you have any thoughts about that whole question?
Sure. In that part of the chapter, we talk about another effect of the diversity regime in colleges and universities, which has been the promulgation of speech codes and so forth. The FIRE organization has done a lot of work on this problem, as you probably know. And we talk about the assumptions inherent in those regime speech codes that, for example, people will be offended or harmed psychologically if there's some comment made that they interpret as being negative towards their race or towards their worldview. And we deconstruct that assumption as well and show how there's very little psychological evidence for that, and it ignores a lot of psychological evidence we have about the power of resilience in people's lives and the importance of airing different views in the marketplace of ideas and the importance of that for education and for personal development.
And with respect to educational benefits, I think that's where the diversity regime seems to be most in trouble with the courts. There is some questioning of the notion that diversity, or the diversity mantra as we know it, leads to educational benefits. Is that
right? Well, with the recent Supreme Court decision in the Grutter case, the Supreme Court has made clear that the linchpin for having any kind of diversity practice in admissions and so on is this notion that educational benefits will accrue. And on the one hand, we have a lot of research showing or suggesting that socio-political diversity enhances student learning and scholarship. Research shows that exposure to multiple perspectives, as one might imagine, stimulates critical thinking, creativity, more complex reasoning styles and attitudes, facilitates values clarification, moral development, and so on. And on the other hand, the research that's been used to support diversity as a rationale when the diversity is based only on race, ethnicity, and gender is far less clear, and many social scientists would say at least somewhat suspect. So, and I think it only that only augurs with common sense that in an educational enterprise, being exposed to multiple ideas, conflicting ideas, different points of view is really what's most important to enhancing student learning and to enhancing scholarship, whether that scholarship is produced by professors or the students working with those professors on research projects.
In your chapter, we've talked about the empirical support for the positions that the authors have taken, and that's a very impressive part of the book. In your chapter, you note political correctness is a political orthodoxy that has a chilling effect on scholarship, inquiry, and debate. Can you point to anything in the book or otherwise where you would see this chilling effect on scholarly inquiry and debate?
Oh yes, there's many examples that one can give. Let me read you a few quotes from students themselves about what they've said on this. One undergraduate psychology student, a conservative, for example, says, quote, "He feels alone with my views among a sea of liberal graduate students and professors, so much that he doubts his ability to be successful in his chosen profession." A graduate student in the social sciences cites the frequency with which her professors write or say demeaning things about people with conservative political or religious views without ever considering the views of their audience. A senior professor urges a non-tenure-track political science professor to delete from his resume work on conservative scholarship and on a Republican campaign, and perhaps not to engage in that kind of scholarship, speculating that this might explain his failure to land a tenure-track job. So it has a chilling effect in terms of causing professors or students to not pursue various lines of inquiry for fear of not getting a faculty position or not being able to pursue their education. And just to pick out a few examples of how this actually has skewed research, which is what the second part of the book is devoted to, it really does limit the questions we ask and the phenomenon we study, retarding our pursuit of knowledge and the Academy's ability to serve society. We know, for example, that the 1970s welfare program of ADFC wasn't being effective, yet academic sociologists even today adamantly reject that conclusion and ostracize those who take it seriously and seek to do research on it. we know that linguistics, the study of Black English, as discussed by John McWhorter in his chapter, has been skewed by identity politics and has influenced not so much perhaps in the current day, but in the recent past, elementary school education, in turn making it harder for struggling Black children to learn to read. We know in English departments that there's a depressing uniformity of approach as literature departments study a wider variety of works than they did in the past, but now only through the narrow lens of race, class, and gender. In my own discipline of psychology, I'm a lawyer as well as a psychologist, we can look at how the discipline of psychology has studied things like the competence of adolescents to make abortion decisions or to be held criminally responsible for their crimes. We can look at research on intelligence and the possible genetic basis of intelligence. In history, for example, Victor Davis Hanson in his chapter talks about how history is now being used to achieve social change rather than to describe the past. And so the goal of history now is often to indict the West, and the United States in particular, as an inherently pathological oppressor of the other. So a really skewing and biasing of the topics chosen and the agendas behind the choice of topic and how it's researched.
In that regard, I'd note Paul Cantor's contribution on the English departments, in which he talks about the way in which the national market and the influence of the top departments has gradually moved through the country and turned, as he puts it, English departments have become the Walmarts of the academy, and local and regional differences between and among departments have largely disappeared.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an example of what we're talking about in terms of this kind of homogenization of the focus being on, you know, analyzing works of literature or approaching literature from the lens of race, class, and gender. That's kind of the dominant ideology or approach or analytical method of doing literary analysis and so on, so that we may be looking at a greater number of works as we go beyond the traditional Western canon, but the way we analyze them, it's through this perspective of, again, through the diversity perspective as it's currently practiced in education of issues of race, of class, of gender, and sexual orientation. If one looks, for example, at the dissertations being produced now in English departments by PhDs, and if one were to analyze what the mode of analysis is or what kinds of topics were being addressed, you see an overwhelming percentage of them through the lens of race, gender, and so on.
I guess then we've seen that there is an imbalance. We've seen why it might, how it might have come about and how it is being reinforced. We've seen some of its effects. And so that kind of prompts the question, what do we do now? And Caesar and Maranta, who write about the political science departments, say that universities are not, or at any rate should not be, representative institutions that are asked to meet the criterion of what political scientist Hannah Pitkin once called descriptive representation, or a mirroring of society at large. If there's no real legal entitlement to a socio-politically diverse university faculty, how should we move forward, Richard?
Well, I think it's much easier to document the problem and describe the problem's effects on education and on scholarship than it is to imagine what the solutions might be. And I say that, going back to this groupthink problem that we have that exists, that you have such an entrenched majoritarian view and majority that it's difficult to know, which only seems to be accelerating in recent years, that it's difficult to know what one might do about it. I think the solutions have to come in large measure from outside the university, outside the academy, acting to put pressure on the academy and affect the academy. So I think, for example, I think trustees and alumni need to get much more involved Stephen Ann Neal of the talks about this in her chapter about the role of alumni and trustees. I think the public needs to get much more involved. I think we need to have greater openness and transparency and accountability. That's discussed in the chapter by former Senator Hank Brown, who was previously president of the University of Colorado. And one very interesting proposal that has already met with some success is discussed by Stephen Balch in his chapter, is for the creation of centers or think tanks within universities. Often these are created, at least initially, through outside funding. That such centers, one has been established at Princeton, another at Brown, for example. These centers may focus on anything from American history to free market ideas, and so on, but they lay the groundwork for through the center and the work of the center that allows professors and interested students to explore more conservative ideas and to start a place at the university where you can start to assemble a faculty and start to assemble research that will go beyond the liberal hegemony. So I think that is probably a very encouraging trend that has already borne fruit at several schools and really allows the opportunity for interested and concerned alumni and boards of trustees and so forth to get involved, because it's rarely the case that a college or university will turn back money. And if someone comes in with an idea that they're willing to fund the establishment of a center or a program at a university, many colleges and universities are going to be very receptive to that. So I think that that's something that we can look to as being very hopeful. But I think in large measure, any change is going to have to come from the outside, from people outside the academy or people who are not within the professoriate, people like boards of trustees, members, and so on, putting pressure on the academy, seeking to start new programs. And one very specific example of this is there recently, as you may know, there recently was a problem at the University of Delaware in their residence life program, where they sought to initiate a diversity program in their residence life halls that really was an indoctrination program of freshman students, and it's pretty remarkable what was included in that program. That became public, and as a result of pressure by alumni and the public and students as well, that program only existed for about a year, and through public pressure it was eliminated. So, you know, I think it's up to all of us, in effect, to work towards trying to make these changes.
Should conservative scholars bash their head against the door, display a little more resilience if that's what they're interested in? Now, I know of one who's going to work in political science, which is somewhat less of a politicized environment. But that said, should students try to do that, or do there in reality, I guess, when conservatives and moderates tend more heavily to go to professional school, aren't they acting rationally anyway?
I believe that's the case, and it's difficult when you're a tenured professor. That puts you in one situation, and it's much easier to speak out. It's much easier to research politically incorrect topics and so on than it is when you're a graduate student or when you're an untenured professor. But I certainly think we should encourage professors and students of all stripes and at all levels to, in their teaching, in their research, you know, give time and give voice to other viewpoints. But depending on the school you're at and the department you're in and whether or not you have tenure and so on, that can be easier said than done.
Klein and Stern suggest that the social democratic dominance within the humanities will grow increasingly insipid and that change will come with time. Do you think that's overly optimistic? Do you think rephrase it, I guess, is there kind of a counter a contrarian impulse.
Mm-hmm. I think there may be. I probably am less optimistic than they are, especially given what we see in the numbers with the problem only seeming to accelerate in recent years. So there is a one thing that academics like to pride themselves on is being contrarian, at least to some extent, probably. But I don't know that they're going to be contrarian when their own ox is being gored if they have to do so. So I, you know, many academics really cherish their political values, and it really is, as I said, a big part of their personal identity. So I probably would be less optimistic than they are unless some of these other measures that we were talking about a moment ago, pressure from the outside, can be brought to bear to, in effect, embarrass them into doing so. But I'm not so sure I'm quite as optimistic as they are.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Redding. Is there anything you'd like to add? I think that this is a remarkable book. It covers a very important subject, and it covers it very comprehensively, and I appreciate very much the work that you and the authors have done.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I think one thing I would like to add in closing is that in our book, we did not deal with the discipline of law and look at what's going on in law schools, and that's something I would like to do as a next step. That's something I have on my radar screen. Law schools are actually less politically correct than most other academic departments, which is one reason why we didn't focus on law schools in the book. But there's enough of a problem, certainly in law schools as well. So that's something on the agenda for the future.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.